Welcome to the Freshman 15, a film discussion podcast where we focus on the freshman works of 15 notable directors.
Each episode, we talk about a different freshman film, what's good, what's bad, what themes and stylistics the director went on to use in later films, and what was kicked to the curb.
Also, we'll give you our opinion on whether the film stands up, if it ever did, or if it's for completists only.
I'm Daniel Long. I studied film at Cal State Northridge. I work with college students, and I just love film. I like to think about them. I like to find meaning in them that probably isn't there.
And I'm Jeremy Bear. I was a trapeze artist as a child, and then my parents were killed in front of me, and so I became the protege of a crime fighter.
Should we get started?
Yeah, let's do it.
It's a home park.
It's very pretty.
Yeah, just simple lines intertwining. You know, very much like I'm really influenced by Mozart and Bach, and it's sort of in between those. It's like a Mach piece, really.
What do you call this?
Well, this piece is called Lick My Love Pump.
So, Daniel.
Jeremy.
I had something really cool happen the other day.
All right.
I was looking through some old stuff, my grandfather's letters, and I found one that he had written to my grandmother back, like, when he was leaving for the war.
Okay, which war?
The big one, WW2.
Oh, yeah, makes sense.
I still have it here if you want me to read it.
I'd love to hear it.
It's beautiful. It's how he felt about her. This is what he said. He said, Dear Dicey, these are some thoughts that I've put together for you, and I just hope that you, well, whatever, he goes on. But this was the part that struck me. This was the poem. He said, okay, right here. Big bottom, big bottom. Talk about mud flaps. My girl's got 'em. Big bottom, drive me out of my mind. How can I leave this behind?
It's beautiful.
I know. I was like, Grandpa.
How did you feel reading that? Did you feel dirty?
I should have. Well, anyway, needless to say, that today's film is, of course, the freshman film of Rob Reiner. This is Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap, the tap.
Yeah, it's about time. Of course, you know, it's a departure from where we went the very first episode, which was, you know, the bloody and grisly Blood Simple.
I mean, there's some similarities in that there's music in both.
That's true. Well, anyway, you know what? Let's start. Not everyone has probably seen Spinal Tap, although God knows why not. But maybe for form's sake, we should summarize the film. Do you want to do it?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. Spinal Tap is a band in the early 80s. They've been around for quite a while up until that point, and they're going on a North American tour. What ensues is a lot of sadness for the band, a lot of tragedy. You know, the typical glam rock, metal, hair metal story. They break up, or at least some of them leave. Then they get back together, and really the film ends in Japan.
That was a great summary. You mentioned, like, you know, the metal glam rock. I'm going to admit to you, I'll be completely transparent about it. I don't always know, like, genres. That's what that is. That's metal glam rock. That's what you call Spinal Tap.
That's what I'm going to call it.
I believe you. By the way, I'm not trying to be snarky or
something. No. It's metal glam rock.
Yeah.
That's the official name.
But you wouldn't call Spinal Tap heavy metal.
If I was going to use the word heavy in that description, I'd probably say heavy glam metal.
I mean, you could have said, "Oh, well, it's rockabilly or something." I don't know what rockabilly is. I would believe you. I doubt it's rockabilly.
It's close, but it's not there.
It's a fake documentary. I think they even maybe invented the term mockumentary for Spinal Tap. Am I wrong?
No, I think it sounds right. I mean, because there are films like this before, but I think this is the film that coined that term.
Oh, really? See, I didn't even know that there had been mockumentaries before.
Just a few. I don't remember the titles, but I know there were a couple.
Interesting. Do you remember when you first saw Spinal Tap?
I do. Someone showed me Best in Show, probably when I was late high school. Loved the film. Watched Waiting for Guffman. And thought that's where it started. And then, of course, someone said, "Have you seen Spinal Tap? It's done by the same guys." So I watched it right around there, late high school, and fell in love with it. But I actually haven't, I think I only watched it once then, and then didn't watch it again until now.
I remember specifically where I was in the situation when I first saw Spinal Tap. Yeah, I was, in fact, I remember it was the summer of 1998. And I know that's very specific, but I was living in a house with a friend of mine, and he was a big comedy fan. And he was aghast that I had he was aghast that I had never seen Waiting for Guffman.
Okay, so you hadn't seen either Waiting for Guffman or this Spinal Tap?
No, neither. Okay. In fact, I don't even know that I'd even heard of them.
Okay, but you'd seen Best in Show.
It wasn't out yet.
Okay.
So he was going, and he and other people we hung out with, they were always quoting Waiting for Guffman and stuff. And I said, look, well, what? We went to the video store, which was VHS. We rented Waiting for Guffman. You think I'm kidding? There was no DVD. It blew my mind. Like, I had no idea that this kind of a thing even existed, that this sort of comedy was even a thing. And I immediately was like, what else is like this? I want to see whatever's like this. And he said, which was true, in 1998, he said, well, there's really only one other movie like this, and this is Spinal Tap. And I said, let's go get it. It was probably the same night, I think, the same night, that, you know, it was the next night.
We
ran out, rented This is Spinal Tap, and it was just, you know, it just blew my mind. It was so different. And I'm a fan of, I've always loved comedy, but somehow this just escaped me until then. But I couldn't believe it. It was so great and subtle and inventive and on and on. I loved the fact that it was comedy that you kind of had to work at to realize was comedy.
Oh my goodness, yes, you're right. That's a good point. You do. You have to remind yourself what you're watching hasn't happened. Isn't real.
And you know what? It's I'm sure you've probably heard some of the same stories I have. Like, so many people, when Spinal Tap came out, had to be told that it was not real. In fact, there's a famous story of Ozzy Osbourne.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Have you heard the Ozzy Osbourne story? So, of course, he saw the film, and it may be urban myth, but apparently he saw the film and didn't realize until afterwards that it wasn't real, until someone said, no, Ozzy, this is a fake band.
Yeah, and I heard that actually, like, Tom Waits, not that he thought it was real, but he'd watched it and was sad because of how true it felt.
Yeah. I've heard that so many times. I've heard that from friends that have had bands, you know, a couple of which bands of some success. And he says it's eerie how much that is the story of any band, in a way. There's always, they go through the same cycles, you know, there's the girlfriend, and there's the manager who gets upset, and there's there's the arguments, and then they're behaving like children, and there's, you know, and it goes on and on. And Spinal Tap somehow, they had to have, I mean, it makes you think, did Michael McKean and Christopher Guest and Harry Shearer, were they part of bands that they knew that?
I mean, it seems like that, I don't know if they were part of bands, but certainly they're incredible musicians.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they're playing the songs, and they're singing the songs. So you'd have to think that if they weren't in bands, they probably knew people who were.
Yeah. But the thing that's also remarkable is the fact this is Rob Reiner's very first film.
What a great first film.
It's pretty weird that your first film, I mean, I think we talked about it last time with the Coen brothers about how your first film needs to be kind of a Hail Mary. And it has to be a not safe venture, but holy cow, talk about the not safe of the not safe. I mean, if your first film is in a genre that hasn't really even been invented yet.
Yeah. And then not only that, like, you're spending money to make this film and you have these people who are your actors and you don't necessarily have a script for them. Mm. And you're kind of going, you're figuring out the film as you're making it.
What about Spinal Tap makes it specifically a Rob Reiner film?
Oh, that's a hard question. I was thinking about that. You have this story of discovery, in a sense, of kind of like relationship, which I think I see at least in his first few films. To be honest, I haven't seen a lot of recent Rob Reiner films.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say that right now.
I have not either.
And mostly because I haven't wanted to.
It's fair.
But his earlier films, there's a certain level of intimacy among the characters and a really care and concern for one another that you see, and you want to be a part of that world. Which, okay, so there's another thing. There's a world creating in those first few films that I think he does very, very well.
Right.
I mean, here you have the heavy glam metal. You know, you have his next film, The Sure Thing, which I saw only once a long time ago, Stand By Me. And then, you know, of course, The Princess Bride and When Harry Met Sally. All these worlds that he's created with these characters, kind of playing within these worlds.
And you said something that I keep thinking about. He has a lot of films about discovering a relationship or people discovering a relationship, which I guess I hadn't really thought about it that way. How does that work in Spinal Tap?
I mean, I think that we know a lot about the relationship between Nigel and David St. Hubbins that seems to go completely over the head of David.
Sure. And by the way, Nigel is the character played by Christopher Guest, David St. Hubbins by Michael McKean. And they're probably even though you think of Spinal Tap as the trio of Nigel, David St. Hubbins, and Derek Smalls, who's played by Harry Shearer, it's kind of the Nigel and David show.
It is. I mean, I want to talk about Derek Smalls, though.
Yeah.
So I watched this film twice leading up to this, because not because I wanted to be overprepared, but mostly because I couldn't not watch it again. And so I really fell in love with Derek.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the third time, there's something about Derek I really loved. But I think you see this discovery of relationship between Nigel and David. Mm-hmm. And something that at least David comes to maybe acknowledge in some small way.
Yeah.
Toward the end, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. In a way, it feels like it's the Nigel and David show. But even more than that, if there is a front man, if there is a leader, I guess, of the band, you'd have to say it's David, right?
Yeah, you'd have to.
I mean, it seems like he's got the, as funny as Christopher Guest is and all that kind of stuff, it seems like it's the Michael McKean character that more has the charisma and the, I don't know, that sort of presence.
Absolutely. He doesn't change the most, but he certainly has ups and downs larger than the other characters do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You mean like
With his girlfriend. And then, I mean, it's not really acknowledged, but later toward the end, he's sedated. You know, he acknowledges that. He's like, well, maybe I'd feel more if I wasn't so sedated. But you could tell that he kind of goes through that little bit of a transformation of becoming depressed and coping with that and then coming out of it. But I mean, what are some things that you notice or what makes it a Rob Reiner film for you?
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that because I think, I don't think about it as much in terms of like themes, but that's great. I mean, for me, I think about it in terms of style and craft of what he's doing. You notice that Rob Reiner, well, first of all, he was not a director first. He was an actor.
Meathead.
He was Meathead, exactly. And you know what? I think he's probably, is for all the films that he directs, I think there's a generation, my parents' generation, are always going to see Rob Reiner as Archie Bunker's son-in-law. To me, it's very obvious that he's an actor's director.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, last time we were talking about, oh my gosh, you know, the beautiful compositions and the framing and all the stuff that the Coens go through. And it's not that Rob Reiner doesn't do great compositions. I mean, good Lord, you know, if you look at, you know, like Stand By Me, like you mentioned, Princess Bride, some beautiful compositions in those films, but it's not what he's known for. He's known, in my opinion, I feel like you go to a Rob Reiner film for character and performance.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he took to Spinal Tap, is he grabbed three guys that he knew performance-wise were going to hit it out of the park, and he said, do your thing. I'm, you know, it seems like his role was almost to stay out of their way and to just let the audience enjoy what they were doing and what they were saying. The environments and the framing and all that kind of stuff is almost incidental. And in fact, I think that the fact that he's mocking a genre, the documentary genre, the rock documentary genre, if there was one, he already had the stylistics kind of, that was already set and that was taken care of, and he didn't need to worry about that. It was all about, let's get a great performance out of these guys, and, you know, good Lord, he did.
I think that one of the, watching it second and third time, that I loved is and I mentioned this before, but he creates a world that they can actually live in and be their characters within. And so much attention to detail that kind of let them forget who they actually are to be who it was they needed to be for that. And that's why it feels so real.
Yeah. And and for those who don't know, I can't imagine that you couldn't tell this if you watched the film, but it's a completely improvised film. The script exists as my impression anyways. And I know this is how Christopher Guest did his later mockumentary films. The script exists more like an outline where here's the things that this scene needs to accomplish. And then the actors would look and then they would improvise on camera brilliantly because, you know, these are three of the greatest improvisational actors ever.
Right.
But you know, that was it. It had no script in the traditional sense.
So they'd have a point A and a point B and they needed to get it to that point B. Is that kind of how it worked?
Yeah. And you have certain things like, you know, there's the famous, this goes up to 11 scene. Mm-hmm. Well, they had to make the prop that has the dials that go up to 11 and all that kind of stuff. So they know that, okay, this is going to be a joke. But in terms of how they get there, that was completely up to Reiner and Christopher Guest in the moment.
I mean, I think of that the section in the interview that they're doing at the beginning where he's reading off the, you know, the fake critical reviews of their albums.
The review you had on Shark Sandwich, which was merely a two-word review, just said shit sandwich.
Where'd they print that? That's not real. You can't print that.
Christopher Guest breaks.
Yes.
I swear to God, he breaks when he says too, shit sandwich. Yeah. But Michael McKean brings it back and says, no, people can't write that. And you see Christopher Guest, you know, getting back into character and being like, yeah, no, you can't say that.
Oh, man. And I also love, so talking about Rob Reiner, one of the things I loved that I noticed for some reason right away in the second time I watched it was when he's doing the very beginning, right, it's Marty DeBerge and he's setting up what the film is, he awkwardly crosses his arms and then uncrosses them.
Yeah.
But he doesn't even fully cross them. And I just think I love that little moment.
Yeah. But the thing that I find so amazing is everything that I've ever heard about Rob Reiner and the way he directs is he breaks the cardinal rule that they tell every director never to do, which is he does line reads.
Really?
For his actors.
He does line reads.
Yeah. And you know, like you'll hear, I think like I could be wrong about this, but in my recollection, like for like in A Few Good Men or something like that, like he would sometimes stop his actors and he would say, no, say it like this.
Wow.
And they would do it. Well, you're not supposed to do that.
Right.
But Rob Reiner functioning as, you know, dual roles as an actor and not that he acts in all of his films, but you know, he approaches his directing like an actor. Maybe he just knows how to do that. Maybe he knows that there's a certain way to give an actor a line read that, you know, you're still going to get the best out of them.
Wow. I had no idea. That's amazing.
I mean, I direct voiceover talent as part of my job and whatnot. And sometimes if I need something really specific, I'll give them a line read. But on camera talent or something, it's just a big no-no. You don't want to do it. But Rob Reiner somehow gets the best. It's hard for me to imagine giving the Spinal Tap guys a line read. I can't imagine that an improvised movie that he did that then. But whatever the case, I mean, clearly his mind is on performance more than anything else.
So, I mean, in a situation like that, so let's say if they were filming this improv moment and maybe he hears something, maybe there's a part of that scene that works and then a part of the scene that doesn't. I wonder if he would just film it again saying, hey, let's do this again. I liked what you did here. I mean, I don't know. Could you do that in an improvisational situation?
I mean, I suppose you have to. The 2016 release of Ghostbusters just came out. I haven't seen it yet, but I know that one of the complaints about the film is that it just relies too heavily on improv.
Oh.
But it's not, and again, I haven't seen it, so mm-hmm. I can't really speak to it very well. But you put Melissa McCarthy in front of a camera, and that's what she does. You know, she's going to improvise, and
right.
She's going to do a great job. Well, you know, the complaint is with Ghostbusters and with other movies that she's in, is it's become a crutch. It's they're not setting up good comedic situations. They're just setting up move the plot forward situations and saying, hey, throw something funny in. And, you know, Ghostbusters may suffer from that. I don't get that sense from like Spinal Tap, though, that the situations themselves are inherently funny. And then they just let the guys do what they're going to do inside them.
Absolutely. And I think that it's unfair to the actors to just kind of expect the actor to kind of come up with something funny to save a scene or to fill it. Because you do feel, it seems like in Spinal Tap, they're just given so much to bounce off of.
Oh, yeah. So what are things that, I mean, you know, we both clearly have great affection for the film, but were there things about it that you feel like didn't work as well?
So I was trying to find things, because I know this question's going to come up. It's part of why we're wanting to do this. I mean, I feel like I'm just going to be nitpicky here. I mean, I love the film. And trying to watch it critically and don't have too much bad to say about it. If there are a couple things I'd say that I'm like, I don't know if that worked so well. One was, I don't know if they needed the getting lost underneath the stage or backstage and not being able to find the stage. I felt like that kind of lasted a little bit too long. I mean, I actually heard that that's based on a real thing that happened, maybe to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, I think.
I heard that too.
But I don't know. I didn't know if there were so many other funny parts. I didn't feel like that lived up to the other funny bits about it.
Go straight ahead. Turn right the next two corners. And first door you sign, authorized, personnel only.
Yeah.
Open that door. That's the stage.
You think so?
You authorized. You're musicians, aren't you?
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Rock and roll. Rock and roll.
Let's get it.
No, this way. Rock and roll.
Rock and roll. Here we go. Hello, Cleveland. Hello, Cleveland.
You must have made it a long time.
Yeah, those are tough ones to play because, like, for example, the getting lost, the length of it is kind of the humor of it, but at the same time, then it's long. So,
right.
You know, what are you going to do? So the parts that I felt like, just because I know this, I feel like we've all been so overexposed almost to this genre that to me, anything that smacks of we're explaining the joke to you doesn't work for me. And if I'm being completely honest, while it's a funny scene, that's how the very first scene comes off to me. Where
the interview scene?
The very first where Marty DeBerge walks out and introduces the film.
Right.
He comes out and he makes little jokes like, well, I captured the, you know, the sights and the smells. And even the way he says it, he's mugging a little bit. And, you know, all this, enough of my yakking and on and on. Honestly, it feels like something that was shot after focus groups looked at it and didn't get it.
Oh, wow.
I could be wrong about that. This is so totally my own speculation. But it so feels like he's trying to nudge us into understanding that everything we're about to see is fake and it's comedy. And that just doesn't, I just feel like I don't need that. You know, it's not a funny enough scene to justify itself. I would rather the show just start with the logo and, you know, the shot of the plane flying into the airport and the montage of the band and the group and doing everything that they're doing. Anything also that feels this, that's the first thing. The other thing that sticks out to me, and I see this stuff toward the end, the anything that feels contrived. There's certain shots and certain moments that it feels like they want us to feel closure and see the band is together and they, you know, there's a shot that it just bugs me a little bit. It's the shot of Janine and she's
sitting
and she's watching the band, and then you see like the camera kind of tilts up and you see Ian with his cricket bat over her shoulder like, yeah, see, I'm back in charge again. And it's so not documentary-ish. It's movie-ish, you know? And it just feels like, why did you put a movie shot in the middle of a documentary like
this? That happens actually before that, right? When David is nodding for Nigel to come back in. And he comes back in and you see Janine's face like, oh,
yeah,
they're back together. And that's interesting. That's a good point but then what do you do with all the other, I mean, certainly in a documentary, well, maybe not, maybe documentaries now, but the stage productions and all of those live performances were filmed pretty well
yeah.
for them to feel less like a documentary and more like a like a well-crafted film, at least in those.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if you've seen any like rock documentaries and stuff. Like Martin Scorsese did a couple, and you know, if it's a well-funded documentary, there's cameras all over the place, and they're doing. Honestly, most of the concert footage felt pretty legit to me.
Okay,
but I think mostly it was because here's the thing, and this gets into like a much deeper question. Is what is comedy?
That was one of my questions I was going to ask you.
What is comedy?
What is comedy?
And I remember being a kid and trying to figure out what made something funny. By the way, when I was a kid in fourth grade, we had to do an assignment. And the teacher asked, who's someone that you wanted to have lunch with? You can have lunch with anyone, alive or dead. Well, kids are putting down Abraham Lincoln.
Of course.
Jesus. Some poor kid put my dad. Ooh. I know. That hurt. I think his dad was in prison or something.
Oh, okay. That's legit.
I wrote Don Adams.
Okay.
Do you even know who Don Adams
no,
is?
I have no idea who Don Adams is.
Don Adams. He played Maxwell Smart in the show Get Smart.
Oh, okay.
I just thought that this would be the coolest dude to sit down and have lunch with. This is what I thought at like 9. Like I wanted to have lunch with Don Adams. I look back at that now and I'm like, that is the coolest freaking answer I can imagine.
That's a great answer.
It was a great answer. You know what? This is all going way overboard to say I've always loved comedy. But I would analyze this question. Like, what is comedy? What makes it? And the only thing I, even as a kid, I could come up with is comedy is about facilitating closure in the audience. And by closure, I mean you have to make a certain sort of observation or ask mm-hmm. a certain kind of question, you know, a joke. And you have to inspire your audience in a certain way to make a leap. And it's a leap that feels good to them, you know? Like when you say, you know, like what's black and white and red all over? The answer is a newspaper. Well, you're actually getting your audience to say, oh, okay, I'm making a leap that I don't usually make in regular conversation. I'm putting something together that feels good to put that together. I'm thinking about something I haven't thought of before. I mean, that's why, you know, you don't have a whole lot of stand-up comics that stand up and do the same jokes that they've been doing for 20 years.
Right.
Because people have heard them and they've already made that leap, you know? Now, I could be wrong.
I'm not wrong.
But I think that's got to be part of it. But the thing is, like when I think about comedy, there's a difference between, like, I could tell you, oh, so I saw this movie and it was so crazy. Like this woman, she's walking across the street, she steps on a banana peel, and you know, she just goes flying and she lands in the street and her dress flies up over her head so everybody could see her panties, and then she farted. Well, you would probably hear that and go, okay, that sounds like a dumb movie.
I don't know. I mean, the farted part.
The farted part maybe does it.
I just wasn't expecting it.
But how does it change it, though? If I were to say, oh my gosh, dude. So I was walking with my wife, you know, across the street downtown, and I don't know what happened. She slipped. She had her dress on, and it flew up over her head and all this stuff. The entire street saw her underwear, and it just, you know. And I'm telling you this as a real story. This actually happened.
Yes.
And, you know, she fell down and she fell. Then it's a whole different level.
Yeah.
It's a whole different thing. Then it is like, oh my God, that's hilarious and that's horrifying and, you know, all this kind of thing. Whereas, like I said, if you were to watch this in some Gary Marshall movie or something like that, you'd be like, okay, yawn, move on.
Richard Gere, where is he?
Where's Richard Gere? Right. Well, whatever the case, I think Rob Reiner and Christopher Guest and Michael McKean sat down and realized that difference. That if this is something that really happened to your sister or your wife or your mom, then that's a whole different level of funny than something, some contrived setup thing that happens in a movie. And I believe it. I believe that they said, well, how can we get at that? How can we get at that different level of funny? You know, can we make a movie in such a way so that it feels like it feels real? It doesn't feel like a setup comedy routine.
And I think that's my answer to comedy, is what makes something funny is it feels real. It's like there's a level in which I feel as if I'm there, and it's a story that I'm a part of and that I'm watching and that I'm involved in. And it, like you said, it's a story you can tell that it happened to you. And I think that's why the movie's so quotable. That's why people want to talk about it. It feels like you're actually there. And it's one of the beautiful things about the film, I think, in general, is that, yeah, it's maybe satirical in some way, but there's also a level in which there's a respect for the characters and for this world. And they're not, there's a tenderness about it.
Yeah.
There's a silliness, but there's also a tenderness about it.
I mean, you know, you were talking about Derek earlier. Derek has like what, like 10 lines in the movie? But you love Derek for some reason, you know? There's something about him where you look at him and you're like, oh, I know Derek. You know these characters in ways that you don't necessarily know, I don't know, in ways that you don't know the Ghostbusters, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that, so talking about Derek, whom I love this time around,
yeah,
he's the typical bass player in a band. Who is the bass player?
It's Luke Walmorta.
He's Luke Walmorta. That's right, Nigel and David are fire and ice. And one of my favorite lines of Derek toward the beginning, not in the interview, but later on at the party, is when Ian, they're talking about the packaging. And he's saying, you know, they're asking him, so what's wrong with the album? Well, it's hard to promote an album that hasn't been released, right? That's what David is saying. And Ian's like, well, they're experimenting with the packaging.
Right.
And the camera pans away and Derek says, what do you mean experimenting? Are they having monkeys open it? Which is an incredible line. We can talk about this in depth more later, but the Stonehenge, right? So just to,
you can't not laugh at the Stonehenge material. You can't.
You can't. But so the Stonehenge scene, just so you know, just to kind of set it up a bit, they've hit hard times as a band. They don't know what they're going to do. Nigel has this great idea that they should play Stonehenge, which seems to be like an Old Faithful song.
I've got my own suggestion.
Let's hear yours. Let's hear your suggestion.
Stonehenge. It's the best production value we've ever had on stage.
But we haven't got the equipment. We haven't got Stonehenge.
Not yet, we don't.
Let's start.
We haven't got... Please, just a moment.
Look, it's quite simple. This is, you know, Ian can take care of it.
So what they're going to do is they're going to create this big... You know, one of the big set pieces, and so he writes on a napkin the dimensions, and he puts 18 inches on the dimensions instead of, you know, 18 feet.
Right.
And so Ian takes it and he says, all right, I'll take care of it. And so he obviously goes to get a replica of this big set piece that turns out to be only 18 inches, which of course the band doesn't know until they're playing the Stonehenge song, and then it drops out of the ceiling.
Right.
And they're looking at it, thinking, what's going on? And it gets on the stage, and then you have these dwarves dancing around it during this guitar or piano interlude. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But then afterward, you know, they're mad at Ian for doing this. And Ian says, well, let's not make a big deal about this.
I really think you're just making a much too big a thing out of it.
Making a big thing out of it would have been a good idea.
I laughed just as hard at Stonehenge as when I saw it the very first time. The other part that it's such a perfect quintessential Spinal Tap scene is when they're gathered at the grave of Elvis Presley.
Oh my gosh.
It's a piece of perfection.
It
that
is.
Scene. It tells you everything you need to know about the band, about the world that they live in, about their outlook, about their approach, about their talent. So, of course, you have the three guys, Derek, Nigel, and David. They're gathered around Elvis Presley's gravesite. And then there's, you know, people have left flowers and the whole thing. You can tell that the mood is getting a little, you know, it's a somber mood. And you can see that they think, well, this, what's the best way to honor this great legend than to sing Heartbreak Hotel? and they completely butcher Heartbreak Hotel.
Well, since my baby left me.
If I'm going,
since my baby left me.
No, you can't hit that note.
Since my baby left me.
Well, I found a new place
to dwell.
That's all right.
Well,
sounds raga. You don't want to go raga.
No, not with this, it don't.
It does.
Well, since my baby
it sounds like in barbershop.
Well, don't, hey.
Barbershop raga.
Watch the language.
It's a new hybrid.
The king.
Sorry. Well, this is thoroughly depressing.
It really puts perspective on things, though, doesn't it?
Not too much. There's too much fucking perspective now.
That scene gets better every single time I see it. But I could just watch that scene over and over and over.
But why is this form? Why do we find this so funny? I mean, we've talked about there's an element of it being real, and maybe there being a certain level of humanity there. But what about it makes us laugh all the time, no matter what? We've seen it so many times, but why? Why does it still deliver?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think that there's a certain you see dramas getting the awards for their honesty, and you know, I mean, how many it's happened, but how many comedies win Oscars and those kinds of things? It's the dramas that get it because they're so true and they're so human and all those kinds of things. And I think when you go into a comedy, there's this mega suspension of disbelief that has to go on. It depends on the kind of comedy, but I think especially very broad comedy, certainly most sitcoms or something like that, you go in just knowing that there's going to be, it's a silly angle on reality. And I think what really stimulates me, but I'm sure others, going into Spinal Tap in particular, not just mockumentaries, but I mean specifically Spinal Tap, is there's such a, it's a melancholy comedy, if that exists. And that's to me, that's different than a black comedy. Like if I look at Fargo, that's black comedy because this is involving, you know, there's nihilistic elements, there's murder, grisly elements,
right?
And we kind of have to laugh. This isn't that, though. This isn't black comedy. This is, I mean, really, there's no doubt about it. Things change at the very end, but you're watching the death of a family in a way, slowly, and it's a real honest process with real feelings and real emotions and all that. And yeah, they're idiots, you know. In fact, I even heard Christopher Guest and Eugene Levy, maybe it was on a DVD commentary, and they were talking to each other about what comedy is. And they said, I'm going to get it wrong, but they said something along the lines of, comedy is idiots trying, you know. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, is all comedy that way? I don't know. But that's your classic comedy formula, idiots trying. And I think that when you add honesty and emotion and genuine situations and human truth into that, then you have something really special. And it's. I think that's Spinal Tap.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that one of the things that the film does so well is they go all in. There's nothing held back. And I think that's testimony to even Rob Reiner's directing in that film, and maybe even the few films after that, is if you just go for it,
yeah,
completely, and you feel like you have something, right? You have something there, so it's not you're just not balls to the wall and you don't have anything to offer, but no, there's something there, and you just go for it all the way. Then there's a certain level of possibility that there'll be a delivering of something pretty remarkable on the other end of that, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody today, actually, because I mentioned this podcast, and then we were going to talk about Spinal Tap. And he talked about a guy that he knew who was a film director. He was, he was a musician when he was young, and he was in a band and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, as you do, as you get older, he left all that behind and tried to take his film career seriously. He saw Spinal Tap and decided to give music a shot again.
What? That's incredible.
Isn't that insane? And at first when he told me that, I said, okay. But I thought about it a little bit, and I thought, That's not too crazy, I guess, because, you know, it's part of the power of the honesty of this film. You know, I mean, I don't have a musical bone in my body. I come from a musical family, but I can't do music. But I see this film, and there is something that's kind of empowering about it. Not that they make it look easy or anything like that, but it's just when you have that kind of access to that level of honesty about this specific sort of band culture, you know, it's a specific culture. There's something about it that seems kind of cool and kind of doable, and, you know, I don't know. I can't explain it in words, I guess.
So a lot of the work, I'm sure, after comedy like that is in the editing. So yes, you have to do the work in front of the camera, but you have to probably do it so many different times in so many different ways. And you're really crafting something on the other end after all of those different takes to make something funny. And so it's a both and a testimony to what can you do in the moment, but also how can you take what you do in the moment and actually craft it into something that's maybe bigger than that moment.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever heard Christopher Guest talk about how he actually came up with the idea of Spinal Tap.
No.
So Ricky Gervais, he made a series, and you can see it on the web, where he talks about, he meets sort of his comedy idols, and one of the idols that he meets and interviews is Christopher Guest. Well, Christopher Guest tells the story of when he was in a hotel lobby. He looks up, and lo and behold, there's this glam rock metal band walking through the lobby.
And the manager said, where's your bass? What? Where's your bass? I don't know. You don't know where your bass is? No, I think I left it at the airport. You did what? I think I left my bass at the airport. You left your bass at the airport? I don't know. Should I go? You're not going back to the... You left it at the airport. Well, I don't know, do I? Do you know where my base is? I don't know where your base is. You said you left it at the airport. And this went on for 15 minutes. And I sat there and I thought, well, I could watch this for the rest of my life. Yeah. Perfectly happy.
Yeah.
Just to get a change of clothing every day. Shave, change, watch.
That's the power of great art, you know. Is that overwrought to talk about Spinal Tap in the context of great? I don't think it is.
No. Because, I mean, all the elements are there. I think you have to.
Is it that inconceivable? I guess the more we talk about it, is it that inconceivable that the guy that directed Spinal Tap also directed Stand By Me and Misery? Maybe not. I think that's what struck a chord with people about Stand By Me was you can look at that and say, okay, I didn't live in that era, but there is something right. So true about that story.
It feels so real. I mean, it feels like you... And I think that's part of it. It kind of feels like your story in that way. I mean, you kind of were brought into that.
Yeah.
Which I think raises the question that certainly I've asked since watching Spinal Tap and thinking about Rob Reiner is what happened.
How would you characterize the Rob Reiner of the last 15 years?
Sappy, over serious, trying to say important things. And emphasis on the trying, and it feels, at least to me, it feels that way.
Yeah. Do you think you have an idea of where it took a turn?
I don't. I mean, I think reading about Rob Reiner, you know, I guess North was like critically slammed, but yeah. I remember watching it as a kid. So, and I remember liking it to the ability I was able to. So I can't necessarily attest to that being the film, but
I think it was.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, I can't say for sure. And in fact, I'd be lying if I said I saw all of North. But I think there's something that happened there. So Rob Reiner, of course, directed A Few Good Men.
Right.
Now, that was the film that people said, who is Aaron Sorkin? Because this guy is something. And of course, you know, Aaron Sorkin went on to be one of the great television show creators and write, you know, of course, Oscar-winning screenwriter and the whole thing, Social Network. I think that Rob Reiner came off A Few Good Men, and it was such a great success. And he said, "Let's do another Sorkin movie." And he did, which was, what's it called, The American President.
The American President, yeah.
Well, I mean, if you look at it in the lineup, North actually came before the American president. So the, you know, everything, if you read like the, you know, if you look at the posters from North, they all say, they all make reference to it's the feel good movie of whatever came out.
Really? Yeah, so that says that on the poster.
Yeah. The feel good this and the feel good that. And of course, after that, he made the American president, which let's be honest, it's not the script that a Few Good Men was, but it's, you know, it's decent, even if it's a little cheesy.
I mean, you're happy to have had the American president after something like North.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something, I think there's something about that time, around the time that he was making North and around the time that he was making, you know, the American president, that he said, the feel good movie. Yeah. A feel good movie. That feels right, you know? And I feel like that's what he's made since then, are feel good movies.
Yeah.
You know? Nothing wrong with feel good movies. In fact, you know, you could say that even the term the bucket list is in the cultural lexicon. I mean, the phrase existed, but that's that kind of became a phrase because of that movie. Mm-hmm. By the way, a movie no one saw or cared about.
Right.
But that's the Rob Reiner film. How many films has he made in the last 15 years about sweet stories about people who are over 60, you know?
Yeah, true.
Quite a few.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things about the early Rob Reiner films that seem to be different, is that there's a certain confidence in the material, or at least the actors, or maybe the worlds that are created. If you kind of create these situations or scenarios, you'll get something, and you don't have to force something. And those other things do feel, or those other films feel forced in that, all right, I'm going, yeah, like you said, I'm going to make you feel good, or I'm going to give you hope, or I'm going to do this or that with this film. Whereas Spinal Tap, it's art, but it's not, I don't sense it's trying to do anything to me except help me laugh.
Yeah.
Which is a worthy endeavor that I think his films after that helped me do something or feel something, but they didn't try.
Yeah. I think you can define Rob Reiner's early career as he was a guy who took genres and he took them to the next level. I hate that phrase, but you know, he moved them forward, or he turned them around in such a way that it was like, oh, I didn't think about that genre in that way. What's a buddy movie? Well, Stand By Me is a buddy movie, but he did something that was a lot more than your traditional buddy movie. He said, well, what would that look like with a bunch of, you know, with a bunch of 12-year-olds in the early 1960s going to find a body? What is a romantic comedy? Well, you know what? Let's be honest about what romance and sex and relationship are. And he made When Harry Met Sally. You know, let's not dance around what we're really talking about. Let's talk about what we're talking about. And it's one of the most brilliant romantic comedies of all time, you know. What is a fairy tale, you know? And he goes and he creates a fairy tale for the ages in The Princess Bride. We'd all seen fairy tales and we'd all seen comedies, but we'd never seen something quite like The Princess Bride before he came to it. I don't know. There's a part of me that wants that Rob Reiner back.
I know. I want him back. And I wonder if part of it is, you know, he makes these great films and you see these people, these other players who can see what he's able to do with material, with their acting, and they want to work with him. And then over time, he kind of, maybe not, but it seems like he burns those bridges.
I don't know, man. I think he's still getting great actors to be in these mediocre films.
But I mean, like the writers.
Oh, I see.
Like if you have Aaron Sorkin, you have Nora Ephron.
Sure.
And then I don't know who's writing his films. I can't speak to that, but it does seem like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. But it is amazing the caliber of talent that's showing up for his movies. I mean, he's a great filmmaker. I mean, there's no doubt about it. He's a great filmmaker. I'm probably being hard on a guy whose recent films I haven't even seen. I've only seen bits of.
But I just want that. I want that early Rob Reiner back, as you said earlier. I think that's one of the reasons why I feel so strongly about it.
Yeah. So looking at his whole body of work, where does Spinal Tap rank?
I'm going to put it at number three.
Three?
Yeah.
I like the fact that you're really, you know what you mean. You will put it, you have an order in your mind.
I do have an order in my mind.
All right, let's hear it. I mean, I'm not saying you need to go through every film.
Well, I'll give you the first three.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Clearly, you have a one and a two.
Right. So I'm going to go Stand By Me. Then I'm going to go When Harry Met Sally.
Wow.
And then I'm going to go Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
Maybe I would have before put The Princess Bride before Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
But having watched it again, there's something about it that I feel like I fell in love with it all over again in a different way. It seems more important to me right now than The Princess Bride does.
Yeah.
And it, of course, I mean, Misery and A Few Good Men are great films. I feel confident about that answer.
Those are great films. I mean, it's something that, this is a discussion I have with my wife sometimes, is what's the line between a great film and a film that just means a lot to me? Because it's the line gets blurred, you know? And I feel like Rob Reiner, if anyone, knows how to blur that line, because I remember when I saw Stand By Me as a kid, this is a formative time, you know? I mean the act of watching Stand By Me was a formative act in my life, you know? And I remember I wasn't allowed to watch, it's rated R, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to watch a rated R movie, begged my mom, begged her and begged her and begged her, because I thought, if I'm going to see an R-rated movie, this needs to be the one. And I, you know, and she finally relented. Okay, that's fine. She said, you had better not use these words that are in, I don't even know that she'd seen it, but she just assumed that there were words. And I remember watching it and just being so drawn in, you know, I mean, yeah, it felt like, oh my gosh, I mean, this is going to sound sort of sad. I had never heard the term tits before.
Before Stand By Me,
I'd never heard.
Wait, how old were you?
I know.
No, wait, literally, how old?
I'm trying to figure out. I mean, I know, this is how sheltered. But I was just, you know, I remember seeing this and, you know, the whole thing, Chopper Sick Balls and the whole thing. I was so deeply invested in these kids, right. These guys, yes. Like, you know, I just that, even if I didn't know each of these guys, I knew these guys, you know, and I had my own little friends and stuff. And I was like, oh man, I think I was the age that these kids were, honestly, when I saw it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess I'm okay blurring those lines between what makes a good film or a great film and a film that means a lot to me.
It's almost impossible, especially with some of those early films, to analyze the craft because they mean so much to you.
So wait, where do you put it?
I don't have an order like you do.
No, I want a number. Give me a number.
You want a number. It would be similar, I can tell you that. I mean, if you're talking about, if the sole criteria is what's the most inventive film Rob Reiner's ever done, then I think Spinal Tap would be number one. I mean, he took something that just wasn't, and he made it,
you know,
and that was it. And the fact that it's so, I don't really know if it, I don't know how well it did when it first came out. Maybe you know.
I did a little bit of research, and I think it only made around 5 to 7 million when it first came out.
Yeah. It does strike me as kind of like the gather steam over the years sort of a film.
I think the rental business is really what, or the VHS is really what saved it.
It strikes me as one of those 80s films that gets, you know, copies of it get passed around between friends and, you know, dudes like hitting the bong in their basement.
Oh, totally.
You know what I mean?
Gotta watch this, man. Yeah. Is that what people do with bongs in their basements? I don't know.
That's what they do.
Okay.
Yeah. And they talk about tits.
Yeah.
I think because of what's happened in the world of comedy, particularly toward the turn of the century, in a way, it almost became his most influential film.
Mm. Well, of course. I mean, you can't not see it in all over the place.
Yeah. I think I'm probably second would be, in terms of influence, would probably be When Harry Met Sally, because it seemed like every romantic comedy since When Harry Met Sally is trying to follow that template and failing, by the way.
But oh my gosh, that movie is so good.
It's great, yeah. So, the big question, does the film stand on its own?
A resounding yes that goes up to 11.
I think, yeah, I think without a doubt. I think people will, say, I mean, I do know, I have talked to people that are not into it.
You have heard people not like this film.
Yeah.
What about it don't they like?
I think the fact that, like, for example, my wife has warmed to it, but she wasn't that into it when she first saw it. And I think part of the reason was we're so accustomed to this genre now that any way that Spinal, and there's lots of ways that Spinal Tap was still sort of rough hewn, you know, at the time. Can I say that?
Yeah, you can say that.
That idea has had so much shine and polish and, you know, and just expectation put on it right. Since then. And I think it's easy for people to maybe go back to Spinal Tap now and go, well, I mean, you know, it's not funny. Like, and even when I first saw it, I thought, oh, this is great. I thought it's no Waiting for Guffman, but it's great, which because, you know, Waiting for Guffman has that quality. It's like, yeah, well, we need five laughs right. in it and all that kind of stuff. And Spinal Tap doesn't feel that pressure. It just says, you know what? We're going to have whole melancholy scenes and you're just going to have to be all right with
that's
that.
True.
And of course, Christopher Guest is now best known as the director of, I mean, really he carried the torch. Started by Spinal Tap, and he built his entire career on carrying that torch, and he did a great job. And that's something else I wanted to mention. The fact that, you know, I feel like he took the Spinal Tap model and he applied it to Waiting for Guffman, and he just added just pure hilarity in all the, he replaced all the melancholy with hilarity.
Right.
To great effect. It was fantastic. Best in Show, of course. But it was very interesting. I thought that by the time A Mighty Wind came around, he kind of went back to his Spinal Tap roots, and he said, "No, I think I'm ready to make a melancholy Spinal Tap sort of story."
Does that have to do with the music? I mean,
I don't know. But of course, that movie was the
right.
That was the reuniting of the Spinal Tap mm-hmm. guys.
So, what do you mean? Do you think this film stands on its own?
I do. I mean, you know, it's strange as it sounds. I think it is kind of an intellectual film. You know, I think that. It requires something of its audience. And, you know, if you're not prepared to engage with something on the level of something that's not easily definable, you know, are you okay with a little bit of melancholy and heartbreak with your comedy? If not, then don't bother. But yeah, without a doubt, it stands on its own. In fact, it's gonna be 100 years from now, people are going to be watching Spinal Tap, I have no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, I agree with that. You have to. I mean, it's historical. Yeah, it's affected so many different films and TV shows and culture.
Yeah, yeah. It's got to be, I mean, it really has to be, from a comedy standpoint, it's got to be one of the most influential films of all time, I think, which is amazing. Your first time out to do that, that's a high bar.
It's a very high bar.
Well, I think we're going to say that that's all for this episode of The Freshman 15. Thanks for joining us. And, you know, again, Daniel and I, Spinal Tap, we both love it. We both think you should see it. Rob Reiner's early Rob Reiner, I think we're also in agreement. You almost can't go wrong. Later, maybe we're on the iffy side there.
Right. You need to watch this film. You need to watch it over and over and over again. It really does get better the more times you watch it.
It's really Spinal Tap, I think, is one of the reasons that we do this podcast is for these kinds of discoveries that, wow, that was a guy's first film, and that's kind of amazing. And in a way, maybe that could only have been his first film, you know? I mean, maybe it would have been a whole different experience if it had been his fifth or sixth or something like that. So we have a Facebook page, we have an Instagram, which, by the way, our handle over there is freshman15film. A Twitter, also freshman15film.
We have an email, freshman15film@gmail.com.
And by the way, we'd love to hear from you. If you have an idea about a freshman film you'd like to hear us talk about, then please let us know. Or just drop us a line and tell us what you think of the episode. Tell us how full of it we are. We're open to all sorts of input.
Absolutely. And if I could encourage you to do one thing, it'd be go and smell the glove.
Smell the glove. Exactly. Thanks again. My name's Jeremy Bear.
I'm Daniel Long.
And we'll talk to you next time.
See ya.